Well, hello and welcome to Bookshelf. My name is Deborah Heath and I am one of the regular reviewers. I am a St Albans based writer and musician, and usually I discuss books with Rob Pearman, but due to social distancing, of course, that isn't possible. So here I am at home recording this with someone who I think is our youngest ever reviewer. So I'm going to get you to introduce yourself.
Hello, I'm Lex and I'm 12.
And you like reading a lot, Lex. What sort of books do you usually like to read?
I like adventure, crime, past fiction.
Historical fiction. Yeah. Would you like to introduce this book and tell everyone what we're reading and who wrote it?
So we have read Spies by Michael Frayn.
He was born in 1933 and he came from a fairly poor family. He was a grammar school boy. So when war broke out in 1939, he would have been about six, and about 12 when it ended. So about your age, Lex, which is quite interesting. So I think, I don't know if you agree with me, that all this experience comes through in his novel. Spies won the Whitbread Novel of the Year in 2002, and the same year it won the Bollinger Woodhouse Prize for Comic Literature. There are little bits of everyday humour in there, but I wouldn't call it a funny book particularly. So I first read the book about the time it came out in 2002, and it appealed to me because, of course, I like Michael Frayn anyways as a dramatist, but also because, like my son, I really like historical fiction, particularly if it's set in the Second World War. And it left a big impression on me. I suppose I felt like I was a part of it. It was an adventure story. It was a very compelling read. So why did I read it again and why did I read it now? Because Lex and I wanted to share an experience of our own. So we thought we would read it together. So being partially sighted, I listened to it. Lex, fortunately having full sight, was able to read it himself. And it seemed like a really good time to do it because during lockdown, it seemed to feel a little bit like the war. And in the run-up to VE Day, you know, everything started feeling a bit nostalgic. So let's talk about the story. So what's our main character called, Lex?
He's called Stephen.
The book starts with Stephen as a grandfather. He's a not much older man living overseas, and he returns to his hometown in England, where he feels he needs to come to terms with something that happened during World War II. In the early stages of the book, it isn't clear what that is. And I suppose this is where I felt the book let me down a bit, because on rereading it, I did find the beginning a little bit slow to get going. I suppose I was so desperate, Lex, for you to enjoy it as much as I did. I was really, really aware of this. So let's talk about Stephen. He was a bit of a misfit, wasn't he? He was a bright boy, but he wasn't as wealthy as some of the other children. There were other children on his road, but his only real ally was a boy called Keith. And can you tell everyone how Keith and his family were very different to Stephen's?
They were quite strict.
They certainly had their rules,
yes,
didn't they?
Yes.
We know that Stephen had a brother. What about Keith?
He was an only child.
Living with these very traditional parents and a mother who seemed almost perfect. He didn't ever say she was beautiful, but she was very well presented. And then this father who hung out in the garage and spoke very clipped speech. All right, old boy. So this story comes about when Stephen and Keith are engaging in their normal sort of play activity. But let's talk first about how they hung out together. So they would spend time together, but did they do that in both people's houses or in just one of them?
Just Keith's, because I think it says in the book that Stephen could not imagine like Keith coming around to his house.
Absolutely, yeah. He was embarrassed about his house, wasn't he? Because it was dirty and he shared his bedroom with his brother. And Keith didn't really seem to be allowed to leave his house. So our first quote is about this, really. This interesting situation, this friendship that has developed on the terms very much of only one of the boys in question.
I try to imagine the impossible happening and Keith asking his mother if he might play at Stephen's house. I laugh at the thought. His mother's reclining on the sofa in the sitting room, looking up from her library book. She raises her perfectly plucked eyebrows a quarter of an inch. What is she going to say? Actually, I know precisely what she's going to say. I think you'd better ask Daddy about that, darling. And what would Daddy say if Keith somehow found reason and courage enough to persist with this preposterous request? Would he actually turn to look at Stephen for once, in sheer astonishment at the effrontery of the invitation? Of course not. Nor would he reply to the question. He'd simply say something like, "Have you oiled your cricket bat yet, old chap?" And that would be that. They'd go to the kitchen, ask Mrs. Elmsley to give them a newspaper to spread over the floor, and they'd oil his cricket bat. What puzzles me, now I look back on it, is that Keith's parents had ever allowed their son to build underground tunnels and overhead cable cars to Stephen's house, to go birds nesting and monkey hunting with him, to invite him to play with his perfectly cared for toys and help clean his special sports bicycle.
We know about Stephen, he's an ordinary boy, maybe not particularly confident. What about Keith? What don't you like about Keith's character?
Well, it's not that I don't like it, it's just not the sort of person my friends are. I mean, he's not the loyalist of friends and he's not the kindest of friends, but they are friends and they do respect each other, if you get what I mean.
I feel that Keith is quite a lonely boy, yeah, because he's an only child. And the way I see it is, yes, there is a certain amount of loyalty towards Stephen, of course, but Keith is very much the boss.
Yes.
So let's talk about what they play with, because this is the crux of the book, really. Everything stems from a strange game that they're playing. So when you play with your friends, it's generally, yeah, computer games, isn't it? Or,
yes,
you go for a Pokemon walk or whatever. I remember you saying to me that what these boys thought of as play is something you would have done when you were much younger. Can you talk about that?
Well, what they play is like games in the woods and stuff.
And they were building a railway, weren't they,
yeah,
as well?
And that's what people who live now would definitely be doing earlier in life.
But I suppose they do it in a different way,
yeah,
and they're doing it in a sort of engineering way, in the way,
yeah,
that you would do Lego and stuff. So they don't just make the railway. They have a den that they share, don't they? And they have little projects and enterprises. Let's find out a little bit more from the book about the sort of things they do to pass the time.
We had a great many enterprises and projects in hand, and in all of them he was the leader and I was the lead. I see now that he was only the first in a whole series of dominant figures in my life whose disciple I became. His authority was entirely warranted by his intellectual and imaginative superiority. It was Keith, not me, who devised the overhead cableway that connected our two houses, along which messages could be catapulted back and forth, like bills and change in the local grocers, and who'd gone on to develop the amazing underground railway, operated by pneumatic pressure, like another cash system we'd seen on expeditions to a nearby department store, through which we could ourselves pass swiftly and effortlessly back and forth, unobserved by the rest of the neighbourhood. Or, at any rate, the cableway and pneumatic tubes along which we and our messages would pass as soon as we put the plans into effect.
So it's early on in the book, during one of their chats in their hideout, that Keith announces something very interesting, and this is really what kick-starts the action of the book.
From those six random words, anyway, came everything that followed, brought forth simply by Keith's uttering them and by my hearing them. The rest of our lives was determined in that one brief moment as the beads clinked against the jug and Keith's mother walked away from us through the brightness of the morning over the last of the fallen white blossom on the red brick path, erect, composed, and invulnerable. And Keith watched her go with the dreamy look in his eye that I remembered from the start of so many of our projects. "My mother," he said reflectively, almost regretfully, "is a German spy."
After this particular bit in the book, the story really picks up the pace.
And they start stalking his mother,
yeah,
don't they?
Yeah, it becomes one of their games. Well, they feel she's doing something suspicious, and they want to know exactly what's going on.
So what is it that is suspicious about her behaviour? What do they notice?
Well, she keeps disappearing when she says she's... Like, for instance, she says she's going to the shops, but then they look and she doesn't go to the shops.
And she seems to, like, disappear very quickly,
yes,
doesn't she? Which is another thing. So this becomes one of their games. They're stalking his mum, I don't think she realises at first, does she?
But she does realise after a while.
Yeah, she cottons on fairly quickly. Keith controls the secrecy by threatening Stephen with the end of a bayonet, doesn't he? Yes. That he's purloined from his father's World War One collection. The next quote is a particular favourite section of mine, and it's they wait till she's asleep because she has an afternoon nap every day, and they creep into her study and they find the diary and they notice something in it and they completely misunderstand what it is. So what do they notice?
So they notice that there's an X every month in her diary.
And what I love is that they're completely innocent as to what those X's are for. And they think that maybe she's meeting a mysterious Mr. X, don't they? A German spy. Of course, we know why a woman might want to make monthly marks in her diary. So let's listen to that little extract now.
I put the diary back in the drawer. We'd better just leave it, I whisper. The corner of Keith's mouth registers an almost imperceptible moment of superiority. I remember how often I've been humiliated by him like this in the past. Things start as a game, and then they turn into a test, which I fail. He takes the diary out of the drawer again, and slowly turns the pages over. But if it's something private, I plead, put it in the logbook, he orders. He watches as I reluctantly scribble the date and mark an X against it. I'm halfway to the door before I realise that he's still by the desk turning over more pages of the diary. Something else, he says. A different thing. I hesitate. But in the end, of course, I have to go back and look over his shoulder. He points to a Saturday in February. There's a tiny exclamation mark next to the date. Make a note of it, he says. He turns the pages again. More X's, more exclamation marks. As I record them, a pattern begins to emerge. The X, whatever it is, happens once a month. Sometimes it's crossed out and entered a day or two earlier or later. The exclamation mark, however, has happened only 3 times so far this year and at irregular intervals. On a Saturday in January, on another Saturday in March, and on a Tuesday in April. This last date, I'm somehow disturbed to see, is also marked Wedding Aniv. A gathering sense of mystery begins to overwhelm my uneasiness. I look at Keith's mother, smiling shyly out at us from behind her veil. I can't take it in. She actually is a German spy.
So after that, the suspense and pace just keep on building, don't they? And there are secret passages and hideouts. There are surprising discoveries. But we can't really reveal any more now, can we?
No. You have to read it yourself.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the themes in this psychological novel. The first thing that I really notice is a real theme of how things seem to be versus how they really are. So let's think about Keith's family. It seems very perfect, doesn't it, to Stephen? But without giving stuff away, Lex, is it perfect?
No.
There's something quite unpleasant and sinister under that, isn't there? And I know that we don't have the class divide in the same way now, but you're always saying to me, oh, this friend's allowed much more computer game time than me, or this friend's got much more staff, or they live in a bigger house. Yes. And I think, even now, we always think that there are some people that have everything, but really they haven't.
Yeah. So another theme in this book is, like, teenage self-discovery.
Barbara down the road.
Yeah.
He doesn't really like her, does he?
No.
And yet, do they sort of become, not exactly friends.
Yeah, but comrades.
They're definitely comrades, because there is a point where Keith goes off the radar, isn't there? She's like a co-detective. Being a girl, she notices different things about the suspicious goings-on than Stephen does.
In one part of the book, she tries to corrupt Stephen and try and make him smoke a cigarette.
And I think she tries to make him kiss her as well at one point. It's not just a story about two boys. It's really the story about Stephen and how, at the beginning of the situation, he is a child.
Yeah.
But very quickly, over a matter of, roughly the summer holidays, I suppose. And by the end of that period, is he still a child?
No.
Because
he has changed.
He's changed. He's
into
had
a
change.
Teenager.
Yeah, he well almost into a grown up. He's had change forced upon him, hasn't he? The other thing to quickly talk about is that it really does explore the idea of memory, because this is all based on his recollections. And sometimes he says to himself, no, wait, it wasn't lunch he was bringing out on a tray. It was Elevenses. That didn't happen then. That policeman came then.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, Lex, if you could possibly read this very short paragraph out here, which is about memory.
Okay. What I remember when I examine my memory carefully isn't a narrative at all. It's a collection of vivid particulars. Certain words spoken, certain objects glimpsed, certain gestures and expressions, certain moods, certain weathers, certain times of day and states of light, certain individual moments which seem to mean so much, but which mean in fact so little until the hidden links between them have been found.
Writing this book for old Stephen is him making the links. Although he did solve the mystery by the end, he is still making sense of it now, isn't he? So I think it's a cathartic novel for Frey, and I think he's definitely working through some issues from his own childhood. Let's look at why we think everyone should read this book as well, Lex.
Yeah.
Not specifically an adult's book, and it's not particularly a teenage book. It's just a book that has a very wide appeal.
Yes.
So what would you say are the top three reasons why everyone should listen to this book? It's read by Martin Jarvis.
It's really interesting. If you just need a book to get like into the swing of things again, I would do this one.
So it reawakens your love of reading. So you say it was interesting. Do you mean it was historically interesting?
Yeah. And it was the interesting points of views and stuff.
I agree with you. I think it's historically interesting. It's just a really good piece of storytelling.
Yeah.
It just sips by once you get into it. I think there are some really interesting characters. It's got glimpses of humour, but it's also got some sinister parts. It's a drama. I would say it is a historical adventure drama.
Yeah.
So I think it's compelling. He's an amazing writer because there aren't many writers who can write as well for the screen and for the stage and in novels as well. It's extraordinary, but he can do it. It's not a long book, and I think it will bring you a lot of pleasure and give you that really nice, warm, nostalgic glow.
Well, thanks to Debbie and Lex. Great stuff. Thanks also to Caliber Audio for enabling us to use those extracts from Michael Frayn's Spies, read by Martin Jarvis.